This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 24th of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up on the show this week, we caught the catwalk both sides of the Atlantic as London and New York host their respective fashion weeks.
New York Fashion Week has always been inspired by European designer. And this season, you can see a lot of Nicolas Ghesquière silhouette a bit everywhere.
We speak to Renzo Piano, one of the world's most celebrated living architects, as he endeavours to rejuvenate Italy's much-ignored suburbs.
The suburbs show a beauty for which they have not been built. You know, the periphery of cities are the city of the future.
Plus, we find out about an influential Dutch graphic designer, the man behind a much-loved Little White Rabbit.
Dick Bruna was inspired by Matisse and Leger, and even the style members when he drew Nankin.
All that and much more here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Hello, this is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, to start the show, let's talk New York Fashion Week, which closed last week after days of fashion editors and buyers pounding the pavements in the Big Apple chill, attending shows by the big US greats such as Ralph Lauren, Calvin Klein and Michael Kors. Our fashion director, Daphne Hezard, was there doing the circuit of catwalk shows and showroom visits, and she'll give us the full runway rundown in a bit. But first, let's hear her talk to Klaus-Dietrich Lahrs, CEO of Hugo Boss. Now, Boss seems keen to expand its presence at New York and has shown that it's committed to expanding its women's wear presence. However, as Daphne found out, it seems that New York is going to have a whole lot more men's wear coming its way soon.
For how long have you been showing your women's wear collection in New York?
It's now the third time. We started a year ago, exactly 1 year ago, and the second show in September, and now the third one. So you see, it's a real partnership, and we deliver to the promise to be here for good and to take New York very serious.
And why did you decide to present your collection in New York more than Milan or Paris?
Because we thought, first of all, the US is already our biggest market. Second, Jason is from New York. And third, we found that New York is a very open, modern city, always welcoming new players, new elements. And we thought the same about the New York Fashion Show, and kind of felt attracted to New York for the place to expose and to show women's wear under Boss.
Okay, you were talking about Jason Wu. Yeah. He's been with you for three seasons. Can you explain us why did you make this choice?
We met Jason 3 years ago for the first time. We liked him instantly. We liked his collection. We liked his idea about fashion, how he moved into the fashion world, how he evolved in the fashion world. And he had a pretty precise idea about Hugo Boss. So we invited him to come see us, to visit us, to discover us. And the way he spoke about the brand, the way he saw the future of Hugo Boss in women, in women's wear, was very appealing to us.
And tell us about menswear brands that are entering into women more and more. Is it an obligation today to do women when you're more focused on menswear?
Oh, there's never an obligation. I think it depends on how you feel with men and how you feel with menswear. We are by far the biggest menswear brand in our sector in the world. And we thought, but already more than 10 years ago, it's time to add women and to explore the women world. And that's the reason why we still do strong things for strong shows for women, why we feel that doing men and women can be a very nice partnership and can produce a very nice partnership in the fashion world of today.
Last question. This week it's been announced New York is planning to have its own dedicated men's fashion week. What do you think of that?
It's very exciting. We will definitely follow that. And for us, it's great that the city and the fashion show in New York is expanding into new territories. So we will definitely follow and observe what New York will be for men.
And do you think Fashion Week in New York is changing? We've heard about IMG who's going to buy made fashion. Do you have a comment about that?
No, I think it's too early. We enjoy being here. I think it's a very established fashion show in the calendar for women. And we will definitely actively observe how New York is going to become more relevant for men.
That was Klaus-Dietrich Lars, CEO of Hugo Boss, talking to our very own fashion director, Daphne Hezard, who is here now in the studio. So Daphne, Men's Week in New York, tell us.
Yes, I can break the news now. It's been talked about before, but it's now official. New York City will have its own Fashion Week too, like Paris, London, Milan, and now New York. And the CFDA announced it on the 5th of February, and it will start on July 2016.
So quite a way off. I mean, this is following in the footsteps of London, isn't it? Which last year launched LCM, the big kind of men's collections. It's a hugely important part of the industry, isn't it? Menswear.
Yeah, it's very important. And I think they were obliged to do it in New York too, because if all the cities doing it, they have to do it also. They're following the European again. And it gives the designer a business platform to show during their market dates. And it's an opportunity to demonstrate the collective talent of an important segment of the men's industry. So Tommy Hilfiger, Calvin Klein collection, Michael Kors, Rag & Bone have already registered.
Fantastic. So that will see more and more brands kind of stripping back from Milan, where they used to show. So it'll be interesting to see the effect it has on Milan Men's Fashion Week, but we'll wait until next year to see that. We should also talk about, I mean, we'll come back to sort of the higher end fashion highlights, but talk about more high street stuff in New York, which is J. Crew and Banana Republic.
Yeah, there's a big competition with it. We can talk about almost a war between Banana Republic and J. Crew. As you know, J. Crew was showing a collection for quite a while now, and Banana Republic has decided to join New York Fashion Week too for the first time. So it can be discussable to show mass market brands inside the New York Fashion Week, but it's quite relevant for a brand, especially to give them a cooler direction. Both of them have their own problematic. Like J. Crew is now suffering of being too cool. They've hired Jenna Lyons a few seasons ago, who did an amazing job of communication, of styling too. But then the classic customer, she couldn't find her style anymore in the shop. It was too trendy, too cool, and the price get much higher. So they've lost a lot of money. Like $607 million in the third quarter of 2014.
And so Banana Republic wants to copy that. Is that correct?
No, Banana Republic, who is maybe suffering of the contrary, is too conservative and not cool enough yet. They need to get another target of customer. They've hired another strong personality designer called Marissa Webb. And she hoped that by going to New York Fashion Week, the image will be different and probably better.
We shall see. Let's move higher up the ranks of the industry now, and let's talk sort of some of the main big shows. Do you notice any trends?
Well, I'm not going to be very original if I tell you it's the 70s again.
70s are back.
I mean, the 70s has been the same song since lots of seasons now. When it's not the 70s, it's the 60s. But what's interesting is that New York Fashion Week has always been inspired by European designer. So in the 90s, you might remember that everybody was suddenly doing Helmut Lang style everywhere, like because it was a very strong direction this designer invented, I can say. Then they all went into Prada look, more opulent. And then it was suddenly a wave of Celine with Phoebe Philo, who make a big impression. And this season, for some reason, you can see a lot of Nicolas Ghesquière silhouette a bit everywhere.
But very blatantly.
Almost plagiarism.
Yeah.
Like the lace dresses with high Victorian color, some short length trend, the patchwork jacket, the graphic velvet, the printed legging, the ski trousers in the city. I mean, this is very Louis Vuitton.
Yeah.
But of course, it's 70s, and it's very, and 70s is always very commercial. And we can't also say that Nicolas Ghesquière has invented the 70s look, but It also looked like a Saint-Germain-des-Prés style.
Mm. But it is interesting, though, how sort of the whole fashion industry, you know, suddenly gets behind one look. You know, we're just thinking the Burberry show, which has just happened in London. That's also very 70s. It's just, it's, you know, it's so interesting how these sort of trends do happen and this huge wave happening in every fashion week and, you know, all the kind of designers tap into it and put their own spin on it and make things look a bit more particular to their brand. But certainly, you know, how these trends come about. Overall, what did you like most?
Well, I always have a coup de cœur for Zero, which I really like. It's very simple, elegant. And they're opening a store very soon in New York. I also like Michael Kors collection. And I like the long beige cashmere dresses of Ralph Lauren.
Mm, perfect. Daphne Hazard, Monocle's fashion director, thank you very much for joining us on Section D. And we'll continue the grand tour of last week's fashion highlights as we head back to London for Women's Fashion Week. But next, we speak to one of the most important and distinctive architects of our time. The drawing board of Renzo Piano has hosted the sketches of the Pompidou Centre in Paris, the New York Times building in the city of the same name, and the Shard in London. Now 77 and a senator for life in his native Italy, Piano is showing no inclination to lounge on his laurels. For the last 18 months, Renzo Piano has put his senatorial salary into a young architecture and design collective called G124, which hopes to bring light to the most darkened, desolate and derelict of Italy's suburbs. David Pleasant spoke to Renzo Piano over the phone from his studio near Genoa.
Renzo Piano, it's fantastic to have you on our design show on Monocle 24. Let's start with this project that was started in 2013 when you were made a senator of the Republic. What made you decide to set up G124? Where did the idea come from?
Well, it's a very old idea, actually. I've been always attracted by the idea of the periphery of towns, you know, the suburbs. First, because I was born myself in a suburb. I was born in Genoa, but in the western part of Genoa. And then, after that, I've been working so many times on suburbs, on the idea of the part of the city that is normally neglected. Typically, the word periphery is associated with a bad reputation. Poor, sad, abandoned. In reality, I mean, it's not like that. In reality, there are fantastic beauties in the peripheries. Energy is there. But it's also sometimes even physical. I mean, sometimes the suburbs show a beauty for which they have not been built. You know, they are being built in a kind of lack of interest and affection. But in reality, despite this, sometimes you can find beauty in the periphery.
You speak of that beauty and your interest, your personal interest in the suburbs and the periphery. But in many ways, as you've mentioned as well, it is an area in many cities that's been criticised as a sort of failure, also on the part of the architect, of the planner, who perhaps made certain mistakes, especially in the area of the suburbs in, say, the 1960s and 70s. Do you feel in a way your project is trying to right some wrongs of that period, or is it a different approach?
No, this is exactly what you say. I mean, it's evident that the periphery needs attention because something went wrong there. Somebody sometime asked me, what is the city of the future? And my answer is typically, I mean, it's the periphery. I mean, the periphery of cities are the city of the future. And if they don't become city, urbanize it, civilized places, then this is going to be a problem. It's already a problem. If you talk about Paris, for example, but even London, all the big cities. In Paris, it's typical. The so-called banlieue parisienne, the banlieue, the periphery of Paris, is the center of many, many social disease and terrible tension. So it's exactly the reason why we need to put our attention there. You know, nowadays, for the next probably 30 or 40 or 50 years, after having built bad peripheries, bad place to stay and to live, the biggest challenge now is to work on those mistakes. And typically mistakes don't need only 5 or 10 years. They need a full generation of people, probably a couple of generations of people. People must understand one thing. In all the cities, the 90% of people live in the periphery. I mean, the people living in the so-called center are only 10%. And so the energy of the city, the desire, the big desire of change, are in the periphery. This is where energy is, in the good, in the bad. So it's quite evident that it's a big challenge. It doesn't take years, it will take decades, but somebody must start to do that.
And can I ask you, Senator, how impractically, you've talked wonderfully about the theory and the history of the suburb, as it were, but practically with the G124, for instance, you've decided that you'll rotate the team, as it were, you'll keep it fresh. Maybe explain that. How are you kind of hands-on? How are you controlling and vetting the people involved in the designs?
There's something that you start to understand when you are a certain age, that it's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure to pass what you know to other people. And that's the reason why in my office, in our office, we have a little foundation. We have young people coming from all around the world. They stay with us. They work with us. So it's a kind of familiar thing for me to spend part of my day talking to young people, giving to young people the example. At a certain age, talk or speech don't help. I mean, the only thing that helps is the example. So you sit there and you show. Last year, for the first year, we've been selecting to 600 people, six people. This year, we've been selecting to again, about 600 people. We selected four people. And I meet those people. Tomorrow, by example, I meet them here in my office in Genoa, but in 1 month I will meet them in the office in Rome at the Senate. They work full time, of course. They have a tutor, and the tutor are people coming from my office, maybe people that have been working in my office long time ago and now they are still around. And we select a specific situation in a specific place, in a specific town. Last year we went in Catania, that is a city in Sicily, or Rome and Torino. And this year we are still selecting the place. We'll be on the north part of Italy, but you know, we keep going around and we find specific place where energy is already. You know, because you can't do anything without energy coming from people. And there is a lot of energy in the suburbs. A lot of energy.
And maybe on that subject, if I could interrupt on that subject of energy and maybe the results of some of the work of the G124, let's talk about some of the tangible sites.
One in Catania is a very utopic project from Kenzo Tanji that made the kind of general plan 50 years ago. The result of Librino is that place, is a neighbor of Catania, is a disaster, socially speaking, urbanistic speaking, no public space. In the middle of that disaster, we found a group called the Briganti. The Briganti, the people that occupied a sports center, abandoned it, and they started to help young people in the streets, bringing them to that place, to make gym, to make football, to play music and to do this. Totally illegal. So we started to work with those people and we made legal what was illegal. They are a very small project because they have to last 1 year. They have to cost nothing because money, of course, is negative. So we have to do that. I mean, the money for this project comes from my salary. That's all. I have a salary as a senator and I use that salary. But we don't accept donation for that. We try to do everything with the energy coming from people. And so at the end, what happened is that we do very little. But it's more touching the consciousness of people. So, you know, the result we are expecting from those projects is not big in terms of physical result. We are not talking about making big building or big things. You will never do that in a short time or with no money. But you can do a lot in building up the consciousness of people, young people and everybody about the fact that the city is still a great invention of the man. And in Italian, città and civiltà are the same word, by the way. City and civilization are the same word. And this is what is good about city. It's also what is bad about city when it doesn't work. But that's our duty, to transform the bad in the good. So that's why working on the suburbs is so important for me.
That was architect and Italian senator for life, Renzo Piano, speaking to David Pleasant.
In a competitive and ever-modernizing world, artisan producers are staying resilient and challenging mass production. Monocle Films visits entrepreneurs in Istanbul, Cape Town and Mallorca who champion the art of craft.
The biggest focal point is how can I make this thing as hardy as possible? All these materials over time will just soften and darken and start picking up blemishes and start telling their own story.
Making a Point, premiering now in the film section of monocle.com.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, as promised a little earlier, we're going to be checking out some of the latest trends and also hearing about the important role that fashion has to play in the creative economy as we turn to these shores in London, where the city has just finished hosting its own Fashion Week. In tandem with this, the British Fashion Council and the British Council, which represents the UK's culture and industry abroad, put on an extravagant display of the best in fashion design and manufacturing from around the world, appropriately called the International Fashion Showcase, held in the rather inauspicious surroundings of the Brewer Street car park in Soho. For Monocle 24's The Weekend Edition, Georgina Godwin was both there and back here at Midori House, speaking to the organisers.
I'm at the International Fashion Showcase for 2015. It's the largest free public fashion exhibition of its kind. 110 emerging designers from nearly 30 countries. I have to say it's absolutely extraordinary. It looks unpromising from the start. It's a car park and you go up into exactly what you would imagine a car park is. And then you come into the most amazing glittering room with all of these fabulous, fabulous clothes by amazing designers. And of course, populated by really beautiful people, one of whom is Anna Orsini, who's from the British Fashion Council. Anna, you've put together the most amazing event.
Thank you very much. We started International Fashion Showcase in 2012, the year of the Olympics, and the idea was really to share this platform of four emerging talents with designers from all over the world. At the same time, because it was the Olympics, we had the idea of having a competition, and it is a competition between countries on emerging designers.
So walking around, as we say, 110 different places from 30 different countries, I just want to pick out some of those that struck me as we went past them. If we could start off perhaps with Nigeria, which was amazingly topical with its references to Ebola.
Yes, we have actually these 30 countries come from four continents. So we have Africa, Asia, America and Europe that are represented. And Nigeria, who is the first, as you say, the first thing you see when you arrive, has decided to make a very political statement and almost to sacrifice their clothes because they're showing them wrapped in plastic, approved for export, exactly like what is happening in the country, and they wanted to make a statement about Ebola.
It is extraordinary, and the laboratory is their theme, isn't it? All sorts of scientific instruments too.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, the idea of the International Fashion Showcase was not to add another catwalk show to the itinerary of the international press and buyers and UK press and buyers, but to instead showcase fashion as culture and emerging talents as designers and talent that take the roots and the tradition of craft on the country and transform it in an international language. Mm-hmm. So to make another example, as we're talking about showcase, it would be Colombia, who have used some scaffoldings that they use in their festivals and showcase the work of designers that either from a couture point of view or from an almost denim point of view, create new shapes and make clothes that are ready for a store, which is really where we would like to bring them all. Mm-hmm. For this reason also, we're doing a mentoring program. So these designers, every morning at 9 o'clock, have an hour with an expert, if it is sustainability or sales, PR or e-commerce, so that we can share with them what we discover in London, that you can have talent, but talents need to have a business support and help so that they are ready to become, from an artist, an entrepreneur.
And you reflect that in your website, and it's a very comprehensive website, and you can actually see there's a lot of help for emerging designers. This is how you set up your business, this is how you do it. You've got a kind of step-by-step guide, haven't you? Let's move on to another country that I found very impressive, and this one was Austria, which is all about storytelling.
Yes, in fact, Austria is very interesting because it's the reverse of what one would think, and it is clothes that have inspired writers and poet makers. And when you enter, you have some wonderful wooden boards where on one side you have some words and on the other side you have the clothes, and then the possibility of taking a bit of more time and putting your headphones and listen to the poetry.
Now, that was the voice of Anna Orsini, who I caught up with at the International Fashion Showcase 2015, which is on all next week in Brewer Street Car Park in Soho. It's a free event and anybody can go along to it. I'm joined now, though, by the person who really came up with the whole concept back in 2008. The British Council had been working on various shows like this in different sectors, including architecture, really designed this wonderful thing that we were just discussing there with Anna Orsini. So I'm joined now by Vicky Richardson, who's the Director of Architecture, Design, and most importantly today, of Fashion. She's here with me now. Vicky, thank you so much for coming in.
No, thank you for inviting me.
It was a really great launch party, and of course that was just the start of it. The whole thing rumbles on as we were talking for the rest of the week.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it was a great atmosphere. It kind of felt like being back at Art College with, you know, over 100 designers from around the world. Great atmosphere and, you know, completely international gathering, really. And I think it's this kind of community of designers that we've created in London, you know, as a sort of nexus of international fashion, which is so exciting.
Let's talk about the genesis of the idea, because it's something that the British Council has been working on for a long, long time.
Yeah, I mean, the British Council is a sort of pioneer of international cultural relations. And we have in London, the headquarters, we have art form departments with specialists right across disciplines. And my team, we have curators in fashion, architecture and design. But we also work closely with teams in drama and dance and literature and film. We're very lucky to have a global network of offices in over 100 countries. And we work closely with arts managers in our offices, but in turn they work with the leading partners and the leading organisations in the arts and design and fashion in their country. So we've, via that kind of network, we've established links that can allow us to develop programmes both around the world but also in London. And really to bring designers together for collaboration, for sort of mutual learning and for the exchange of ideas. And that's really at the heart of the British Council's work. So, it's been very exciting, obviously, in fashion because it is an inherently kind of global industry anyway. But I think what we've brought to it is the idea that through fashion you can tell stories, you can talk about wider ideas and, allow designers to really value their national context as well and tell their own story.
Mm. Because the British fashion industry reportedly worth about £26 billion a year. I mean, that's enormous, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And we're particularly strong here in terms of education, in terms of the support for young designers. The work the British Fashion Council's done in this area has been pioneering. And I think we really feel like there's an opportunity to share that kind of learning and knowledge with partners around the world, where fashion is equally becoming one of the leading industries. You know, the development of the creative industries in, for example, Nigeria or Pakistan, the Philippines, you know, the creative sector is seen as one of the fastest growing areas. And I think that we've got a lot of kind of learning experience that we can share.
How valuable is fashion as a soft power tool, particularly for the UK, when you balance it against places like France or Italy, who have perhaps a longer and more extravagant tradition of fashion?
That's right. I mean, we haven't had the sort of manufacturing base, the big companies, that the sort of artisanal tradition that the French and the Italians have had. And I think we've had to put more emphasis on creativity, on new ideas. And so the fashion sector is led in that way. And I think that means, you know, in terms of soft power, we've actually got a great opportunity to talk about a whole set of wider issues through fashion. Not that we'd want to do that in an obvious way, but I think there's a very strong story, particularly about the way that the UK has been so open to young people from around the world to come and study here, to come and set up their studios. And I think that's a great message about the UK, our openness, our ability to learn from the way people do things around the world and to, you know, to really incorporate that into our own identity.
That was the British Council's Vicky Richardson with Georgina Godwin on the International Fashion Showcase held on the occasion of London Fashion Week, which ended today. Now from one fashion capital onto another, to Milan, but this time not in pursuit of beautiful clothes. This year, the capital of Italian design and industry is playing host to what must be the biggest fair there is. The World's Exposition, Expo Milano 2015, represents 145 countries by way of dozens of specially designed national pavilions. The programme will span months and spill out of the Expo fairground to the city and the region beyond. As the May the 1st opening date beckons, our Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo tells us what to expect and assesses how the Milanese are preparing for a huge design event that has not come without controversy.
Well, we're talking about 1 million square metres of real estate that needs to be filled, and there's over 140 country pavilions. Most of them, however, they'll just be there for the 6 months. So if you want to catch them, you need to catch them during this year. Because the theme is looking at biodiversity and farming and everything's very eco-friendly, most of the designs will be dismantled. So these buildings are up for 6 months and that's it.
And let's talk about some of the actual pavilions. It's always quite fun sort of comparing the pavilions, how the countries shape up and sort of rival against each other. Let's go through some of the highlights, the best pavilions in your opinion.
Well, I think what's interesting is if you look at the U.S., in Shanghai 2010, the U.S. was criticized for very corporate, very heavy-looking building. Now, here in 2015, they've gone with a very, let's say, lighter design using recovered wood from Coney Island Boardwalk, and they're going to have a vertical wall with crops from all of the 50 states, and they're going to do this very slightly techy kind of farming system with hydroponics, so no soil, and these robotic arms will be moving around, and they say there's going to be some sort of trapeze artist doing a bit of gardening on the wall. So that should be quite interesting.
And then to the Arab world, to the Middle East and the Gulf states, the UAE?
Yes, indeed. Since Dubai will be hosting 2020, they've come through with a design from Foster and Partners, which they'll end up dismantling and taking back to the UAE to use probably in Dubai, not for the expo there. And so what they asked for was a design that could work also in the very, very hot climate of the Gulf. And so you have Foster and his colleagues looking at these undulating ribbon-like walls made of steel that sort of remind one with the coloration of the sand dunes. So there's a lot of shading and it's quite a long, and at least from the air, it looks quite impressive.
And back to Europe, you know, times are tough in Europe and some of the European countries, how are they shaping up? France, and dare we say that the host country as well, Italy, what are the pavilions going to be like for those two countries?
Well, the French are going with their, what they call it, the classic covered market, again, in a lightweight sort of wooden structure that they can then dismantle. And Italy is going with a very big, obviously, because they are the host. So it's going to be a quite an impressive structure. There's going to be a central, what they call the tree of life, and there's going to be also the open air auditorium. And it looks quite impressive. Again, most of these things will only be there for the 6 months. It won't be like, say, Lisbon in 98, if you recall that fair, where you still have a lot of pieces in place there, like the Caesar Pavilion.
Okay, and maybe if we step away from the fair ground itself, what does the city, what do the Milanese hope to put on for the residents and the visitors to the city?
Well, right now it's gearing up. Restaurants and various businesses are planning to do lots of events in the city, a lot like what you would see during the furniture fair in April. So these 40 salones, sort of the 40 expo events. And one of the most interesting things, because the theme of the expo is food, the food industry, they have a lot of Michelin star chefs led by Massimo Bottura, who's a 3-star Michelin chef from Modena. He's put together an interesting program, which he's looking at taking the leftovers from the catering, the food that's not used during the day at the expo site, which is catered by Eataly, a very well-known gourmet sort of slow foodish supermarket. And he, with other chefs, are putting together meals, being sort of creative and recycling and using this in a soup kitchen. So it's going towards a charity. So it's quite interesting. And they've gotten together 13 designers to design one-off tables in wood. And so I think that's a very interesting event. There are other ones that are going to be coming up. Michele De Lucchi, a well-known architect, who's also doing his own pavilion at the expo, will be doing a food court in Milan's Galleria. So there's a lot of stuff in the city, for sure, that people can see.
And finally, and it would be slightly strange to avoid this question, do you think that the kind of public reception or kind of excitement about the expo is sort of, it's gone beyond the phase that there's been a lot of criticism already, the whole contract process and commissioning was dogged by allegations of corruption and so on in the Italian press. The Milanese getting over that? Are people now just kind of all hands on deck to get this show on the road?
I think as you get close to the opening, we're now about 70 days out, the excitement will build up. The ticket sales are now at about 10 million. That doesn't mean, you know, individual tickets. But there could be a lot of people. There's talk of travel agencies and others buying up large packets of tickets. And I think what the Milanese are hoping for is a lot of tourism, which would be good for the local economy, so for restaurants and for shops. I think they're slowly getting on board. There is sort of an enthusiasm, but it's still not quite at the surface yet.
That was our Milan correspondent Ivan Cavallo speaking to David Pleasant on Expo Milano 2015, which opens on May the 1st and will run until the 31st of October this year. Still to come today, we speak to a curator at Holland's venerated Rijksmuseum about a beautifully designed little white rabbit, and we honour the legacy of Scotland's most famous architect. While Scottish architect Charles René McIntosh is certainly celebrated in Britain and to a certain degree internationally as a master of the arts and crafts movement, many of his buildings were never actually built. A new exhibition at London's Royal Institute of British Architects hopes to bring attention to some of those beautifully drawn designs, many of which were of buildings proposed for London. Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke to curator of the exhibition, Susan Pugh, who is also curator for the RIBA Library Drawings and Archives.
He's more almost, possibly more known to the public generally, sort of as a designer, furniture and so on, and how his style has been sort of taken and almost made into this sort of McIntosh merchandise. So I think people may be more familiar with him in that context rather than as particularly as an architect. So this exhibition really looks specifically as him as an architect, as his training as a student actually at the Glasgow School of Art, and then his role within the practice of Honeyman and Kepi, and then when he later became a partner in that practice as well, so Honeyman, Kepi and McIntosh.
A lot of people, I guess, particularly if they're familiar with Glasgow, you know, it feels like you're more familiar with his works because you actually see the buildings when it comes to the architectural practice. Do you think he's one of these, I mean, he's a bit of a visionary, sort of a polymath. Mm-hmm. Was he one of these people who's maybe ahead of his time to a degree? Or why do you think he didn't manage to secure that sort of legacy during his lifetime?
I think he was both ahead of his time, but also very much had his kind of, almost his feet in several ponds. I mean, you could say that sort of a lot of his work was inspired by arts and crafts movement sort of prior to his own sort of period. He was also very much part of Art Nouveau, that was not so much common, well, prevalent in the UK, but if you look for an Art Nouveau figure in the United Kingdom, then McIntosh is the man to go to. But then he also has elements of Art Deco within his work, particularly sort of his later works. And then you can also argue that he's a bridge towards modernism. So in that way, he really covers a lot of architectural styles and periods. So I think he's both a design icon and also a bit of an enigma because you can't really pinpoint or pinhole him, really.
Now, tell me, a lot of people say, oh, you know, he's known as a great draftsman, sort of, you know, wielder of the pen. If people actually go to the exhibition, will they be surprised perhaps by some of the things that are on display? Are there different, I don't know, facets? You mentioned this sort of multifaceted, but are there other facets perhaps that people won't be so familiar with, which might surprise them in terms of what they see there?
I think just the focus on him as an architect is perhaps slightly more surprising. We don't feature the sort of any of his furniture or a little bit in terms of interior design. We look took at his house for an Art Lover Design, which he may have done partly with the inspiration of his wife, Margaret MacDonald, but it focuses on him as an architect. But it's definitely a fantastic opportunity to see some of his exquisite draftsmanship, the perspectives we've got. His sort of first big work within the practice was the Glasgow Herald building, and that's a very striking perspective where he uses a low viewpoint, so you get a very dramatic view up the tower that he added onto the Glasgow Herald building. So that, alongside sort of other plans and a little bit of watercolour as well, but you'll definitely see his skills as a draftsman and how he's very different and how he's progressed. We also have a drawing from his student days at the Glasgow School of Art, where he did a design for a science and art museum. But there, it's, you wouldn't be able to pick it out otherwise as a Macintosh drawing. It's very much in the classical style, Beaux-Arts tradition, much more in keeping with sort of other trends of the time, and perhaps more in keeping with his later partner, John Kepi. So you will see sort of the progression from that more conventional style to his very stripped down architectural style and draftsmanship.
I think that sort of evolution is fascinating, isn't it? Mm. What do we know in terms of how, you know, Charles Rennie Mackintosh, how did he see himself? Did he understand that he was sort of bridging these different disciplines? Did he see himself as an architect or as an artist or as a designer? Is that important, I guess, when looking back at all of his work? Is it important to consider how he perceived himself?
I think it's definitely an interesting question. I don't know that we could answer the question in terms of style, stylistically, whether he would, I don't think he would have wanted to have sort of, you know, cornered himself into a particular style, but he definitely saw himself as an architect, and I think he was frustrated by the lack of recognition as a professional architect in his time. But equally, he did see himself as an artist, and later in his life he focused purely really on painting. And then there's the sort of an early portrait we have of him in the exhibition. It was taken by Annan Photographers, a very sort of popular at the time and successful photographic firm. And there he's deliberately sort of portraying himself as an artist with a sort of a smock-like tie and so on. So I think he liked to sort of consider himself as both, but I would say probably architect would have been his main drive.
Now, it's interesting, obviously, we're sitting here in London, you know, Reburgh is an august London institution. It's funny that Mackintosh's influence wasn't really felt, as we've already sort of alluded to, during his life as extensively as perhaps it might well have been. And in London, too, it never seemed to really sort of work for him. There's a lot of people who have said, oh, you know, Mackintosh could have had wielded a great influence in London if only he'd been given the opportunity. Was he denied opportunities, or was it something that just wasn't, you know, in the stars, as it were? Why do you think his influence wasn't felt in say, you know, the capital of Britain?
He did have some opportunities in London. I mean, he came here in 1915, actually, and lived here for a number of years before he moved to France. But he was commissioned to do some artist studios in Chelsea, and quite a number of buildings actually on one particular site, but mainly I think from sort of cost grounds that it never really materialised. There was a very small part was actually built, but nothing's recognisable as Mackintosh. So there were opportunities, but I would say probably finances, and also by that point, this is sort of about 1920, 1922, there was already a sort of change in fashion. People were looking a bit more to classicism and Beaux-Arts, and they weren't looking for that sort of individual element. So I think that probably was a big factor. And then also then perhaps his career would have taken off more prior to that, prior to coming to London, when during the First World War. But again, that was a major, obviously played a major part in, I think, not being able to explore those options. He actually went to Suffolk, really for a period of respite and recuperation after he'd dissolved the partnership with Honeyman and Kepi. And then again, it would have, perhaps something would have materialised there, or he was actually looking to go on from Suffolk onto Europe, possibly Paris and Vienna, where his designs were being published and being recognised. But again, due to the war, that just couldn't happen.
Susan, I always sort of ask, if I'm talking to sort of, you know, curators or museum directors, this sort of thing, about personal favourites, and they always say, oh, it's very difficult to choose things. It's like choosing your own children or whatever. Uh-huh. But, you know, if you could sort of augment your personal collection, as it were, with something that features in the exhibition, is there anything, not that you would do that, of course.
Of course.
But are there any things that you just think, you know, you sort of stand marvelling to look at, or there's just something that where the detail fascinates you? Is there anything in particular?
There's a perspective in the exhibition of the Daily Record building that he produced, a watercolour, and again, just the colours, he did glazed brick work on that building. And again, just the watercolour as he's done it. And it's a very dramatic, it's a very difficult, compact site within Glasgow. So to get that angle is nigh on impossible. So again, that sort of enhances his dramatic viewpoint. And that's a very striking work.
That was Susan Pugh, who's the curator of Mackintosh Architecture, which is open now at the Royal Institute of British Architects here in London. And it will run until the 23rd of May.
From her perch in Wan Chai, Aisha Spears is Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. Covering topics ranging from territorial disputes to urban upsets, the luxury goods sector to organic farming, Aisha Spears boasts one of the best beats at Monocle.
From the expanding political influence of Beijing to the growing economic power of Southeast Asia's middle class, we look at the people, businesses and nations that are shaping the exciting Asia-Pacific region.
From Sukhumvit to Orchard Road, Aisha Spears is Monocle's woman in Hong Kong and beyond. Catch her reports and check-ins around the clock right here on Monocle 24.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, to end the show, we're going to take a rather fond look at a very lovable little character. With her round head, long ears, simple X as a mouth and dots for eyes, Miffy has to be one of the world's most famous rabbits. She is in fact Dutch and calls the city of Utrecht her home. Her creator is legendary graphic designer Dick Bruna, and this year marks a series of national events and exhibitions celebrating 60 years of his career as he enters retirement. We spoke to the curator of Dick Bruna, the artist at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum, Caro Verbeek.
Smiddags vraagt Nijntje, zegt Tante Trein, wil je vandaag onze...
In Holland, we call the figure that you know as Miffy Nijntje. And Nijntje refers to konijntje, or small bunny, small rabbit. And Dick Bruna designed or drew Nijntje for the first time in 1955. For his son. He had always been fond of rabbits and bunnies. There's even a picture of him as a child with a huge white rabbit. He drew it, but it was kind of expressionistic and not as symmetrical as we know Nijntje now. But she did wear a dress from the beginning. Why? Because a dress is a better shape than pants and a shirt. So that's the reason he gives for the fact that Miffy is actually a girl. Many people don't even know that Nijntje is a boy or a girl. This dress is kind of a constructivist shape, an avant-garde shape, because Dick Bruna was inspired by Matisse and Léger, and even the style members when he drew Nijntje. The colors of Nijntje have never changed over the past half century. So it's the same red, the same blue, the same yellow for over 50 years. And we see Nijntje developing over the years. In fact, the shorter the ears, the more recent the design. The lower the eyes, the more recent the design. And sometimes it changes. And we can also tell from her face which emotions she's experiencing.
So it's fascinating to talk about her emotions, for instance, because she has kind of emotionless face, but maybe explain these changes, the morphing of Miffy or Nijntje. Did that come from Bruna himself, or was this when she was used in other contexts?
No, this morphing of Nijntje came from Dick Bruna himself. And the way he explains it as well, I drew the ears in a different way, out of the blue, out of nowhere, and I saw that it was okay. So I continued to draw Miffy that way. And that way the eyes got rounder, more circular and shorter and more parallel. So when they're at their smallest, you know that this Miffy was drawn after 2000. Because that's when her most recent shape appeared.
It seems like the Netherlands is gearing up for a big year for Miffy or Nijntje. There's various exhibitions, the largest being held by you at the Rijksmuseum. Perhaps explain what that character and what Bruna's work represents in terms of Dutch graphic design. Why is this so important?
Miffy is part of the so-called Dutch canon of art, which also includes the Night Watch by Rembrandt or a chair by Rietveld. It has this very clear, bold Dutch design. And over three generations, maybe even four generations of Dutch people grew up with Nijntje, always in a slightly different shape because she changed, her head changed, her ears changed. And I spoke to some Japanese researchers, and of course for an outsider it's even easier to see. They recognize the Dutchness of Nijntje much better than we do. But I can tell that every Dutch child grew up with Nijntje, and my parents and even my grandparents.
And perhaps if we kind of talk about why do you think specifically has she been so successful, especially internationally as well? You mentioned Japan. What is it that makes her so immediately likable?
What makes her so likable for small children is the very clear contrast, the very bold lines. They're so clear, but also that she's so neutral in a way, which makes it easy to project emotions, feelings, what makes her universal, so to say. Everyone can recognize themselves, and she's looking you straight in the face. She's always looking you in the eye. So you immediately get a very intimate connection to her. You almost feel as if you are Miffy.
Finally, what to expect to see at the exhibition which you have curated? Maybe give us a few sneaky previews as to what to expect.
Of course, we do want to show Miffy and Nijntje, because Bruna is famous for Nijntje, but also his work as a graphic designer. Many people in the Netherlands, at least, don't know that he designed over 2,000 book covers for pockets released by his father's publishing house, Bruna and so on. And, well, he created over 2,000 of these covers, and they forced him to use all kinds of styles and ways of creating, like tearing paper, cutting paper, just like Matisse, using photography, collage, drawing, painting, everything. And it made him what he is today, a very versatile artist who taught himself to be an illustrator and an artist.
That was the curator of Dick Bruna, the artist, at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum, Caro Verbeek. And we will be celebrating Miffy and a host of other character designs later in the year here on Section D. And that's all we have time for on today's show. It was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris, and to play you out, we go from one Dutch lady called Caro to another. We have Caro Emerald with That Man. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.